Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM, broadcasting live from the City of Angels. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. We've got a great couple of shows lined up for you over the next two nights. Tomorrow, we're going to take a look at the Kurt Cobain suicide. We're going to talk with the director, producer, and writer of the documentary Soaked in Bleach. Benjamin Statler will be on the air with us, as well as Tom Grant, a retired private investigator and former detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who personally investigated Kurt Cobain's alleged suicide. They've got some stories to share, some insights on this case that may stun you. And if you have not seen the documentary, please check that out on, I think, Netflix, Hulu, all the regular outlets have this. And they said that they've got more information to share with us tomorrow that they didn't even cover in this documentary. We'll be doing that tomorrow, all 4 hours, plus opening up the phone lines, giving you an opportunity to join us and share some time. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Kenny Johnson. And he is a successful writer, producer, director of film and television for more than four decades. And he's the creator of landmark original miniseries V. He also produced The $6 Million Man, created the iconic Emmy-winning shows such as The Bionic Woman, The Incredible Hulk, Alien Nation, and he's directed numerous TV movies and the feature films Short Circuit 2 and Steel. We're going to speak with him in just a short time, talking about the evolution of science fiction. What was it like doing special effects without all the computers and CGI? And we're going to hear some great stories and behind-the-scene anecdotes from all of the shows we just discussed. Before we get into that, though, we'll make a couple of mentions. Of course, the thoughts and prayers of Coast to Coast AM are out with some U.S. sailors. Seven U.S. sailors are unaccounted for after a Navy destroyer collided with a merchant ship southwest of Yokosuka, Japan, early Saturday local time, the Navy said. The USS Fitzgerald, a 505-foot destroyer, collided with a Philippine container vessel at approximately 2:30 a.m. Saturday local time, about 56 nautical miles of Yokosuka. The U.S. 7th Fleet has said the ship, which had experienced some flooding after the collision, and the Japanese Coast Guard were searching for the seven unaccounted-for sailors, the fleet has said. Right now, we're focused on two things, the safety of the ship and the well-being of our sailors, Admiral Scott Swift, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, said in a statement. We thank our Japanese partners for their assistance. There were three injuries. They are still seeking some of these sailors, so keep that in your thoughts and prayers for a safe retrieval and healthy recovery for everyone involved. I just flew into Los Angeles, and boy, had I read this and heard this news story, I don't know that I would have been as excited about getting on an airline, but flight was canceled only after a passenger spotted fuel leaking out of the wing before takeoff. Thankfully, somebody was actually paying attention. Earlier this week, a United Airlines flight scheduled to depart from Newark Liberty International Airport was canceled. Why? Because a passenger looked out of her window and saw jet fuel gushing out of the wing. The passenger stated that she alerted the crew to the issue and posted a video of the fuel leak to Twitter. According to the Telegraph, United stated that they had taken the plane out of service but didn't explain what caused the leak. As for the passengers, they're given hotel rooms for the night and booked on later flights. But of course, one question still remains. If the passenger hadn't seen the fuel pouring out, would the flight have even taken off? That's scary. Hope that everybody's on board with that now, keeping a little bit closer eye. And since we're talking sci-fi, let's mention the new news coming out today. The coroner has released results of Carrie Fisher's untimely death in the death inquiry. Officials say that actress Carrie Fisher died from sleep apnea and a combination of other factors, but they cannot conclusively determine what caused her death. Los Angeles coroner's officials said in a news release late today that Fisher had buildup of fat in the walls of her arteries. The release states that Fisher had taken multiple drugs prior to her death, but that investigators could not determine whether they contributed to her death in December. The agency did not immediately respond to a request for additional details about whether a full autopsy report and toxicology results were available. Fisher suffered a medical emergency on an international flight back on December 23rd. Her mother, longtime movie star Debbie Reynolds, died the following day. I also would like to make a quick mention. I popped in on the show last week with Richard Syrett briefly to remember the passing of Adam West. And I was here last night. It was fascinating. They did a really great tribute for Adam West, Adam's family, Burt Ward, Lee Merriweather, and some other people from the Batman franchise were there on hand as they lit up Los Angeles City Hall with the bat signal. And it was so beautifully done, and it was a great turnout. I had a chance to go down there and see this, and as a lifelong superhero nerd, I just absolutely adored this, and missing Adam West, it was great. But we had a chance to discuss briefly my encounters with Adam and how amazing he was. I also made a mention that my daughter was diagnosed with last Saturday with type 1 diabetes, and had asked for prayer and healing requests from the audience. And I just want to thank the Coast audience, always delivers you guys such a beautiful outpouring of love and support, and emails that I received from you regarding that announcement. Just to update you, she's doing well. We're in the midst of making this new transition in life and understanding how to deal with type 1 diabetes. But as a father, let me tell you, it was, if you start to notice dramatic changes in your children, especially between the ages of 9 and 12, you notice that they're slimming out, they're drinking more water than usual, their bathroom breaks are multiplying, don't be afraid to ask to have them examined and checked, because this was almost unidentified. There's no immediate diabetes in our family. There was no way to foresee this coming, but we happened to luck out, and my girlfriend had a blood testing kit, tested her, and found that she was pinging up at 590, which is extremely high, and we were alerted to get to the hospital immediately before she went into a diabetic coma. She is safe today and healthy and doing well, and we'll be keeping you updated on that. But I just wanted to take a few moments to thank everybody that thought about me and did that. Another quick question and request for you. My co-host and producer of Beyond the Darkness and Darkness Radio, Tim Dennis, is in the hospital. Another bout of infection in his Charcot foot, possibly in the bone. Doctors are talking about doing bone and tissue biopsies in the morning. They're also talk of sepsis. It's all over the place. They're talking about treating it with a PICC line and long-term antibiotics and possible amputation. So, of course, Tim is a big part of our lives and has been. So if you can keep him in your thoughts and prayers, Tim Dennis out in Minneapolis, we love you, buddy, and we're wishing for a full recovery and a quick recovery on that. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Kenny Johnson is here to talk about some of the most iconic TV programs, some of the TV programs I loved and grew up on. We're going to talk about that, his new projects, and what's going on. We'll do that when we return to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. For George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader, sitting in for tonight and tomorrow night. Boy, growing up in the 70s and 80s, kind of the silver age of really great TV, there are some shows and miniseries that stand out far above the rest. And this is in no means a way to just stroke the ego of my guests this evening, but I can honestly say that of the shows I adored growing up, The $6 Million Man, the Bionic Woman, The Incredible Hulk, Alien Nation, and of course, the miniseries V was groundbreaking. You caught me watching every one of these shows. And I know from watching social media that these were the same kind of shows that influenced so many of us. Well, we're lucky enough tonight to have Kenny Johnson, and he is a successful writer, producer, director of film and television for more than four decades. He's been the creator of landmark original miniseries V. He's produced all the shows we just mentioned and been involved in the creation and follow-up on these shows. He's here with us tonight to talk about these amazing TV series, the way it helped shape the face of programming at that time. And folks, this is long before CGI and all of the tricks of the trade, and it was still amazing TV that holds up today so well. Kenny, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Dave, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for such a splendid, I'm overwhelmed.
This was amazing to me. This was appointment TV, which you don't find as much anymore. You don't see people really kind of gathering to watch the show, but all of these shows were such family friendly, entertaining, and just in it, educational as well. You guys snuck in some really great science and legend into these stories, and it really impacted, I think, many generations of filmmakers and TV and everybody that's out there right now, and they owe a lot to people like you that were at the forefront of this.
I was standing on the shoulders of giants, Dave.
Only bolstering the giant that you are as well.
Yeah, this is part. Thank you so much.
This is great. Now you actually have kind of an interesting story to start us off.
Regarding Coast to Coast AM, right? Yes, it's funny. I have a Coast to Coast story about this show. 2 weeks ago, I was flying back to Baltimore from L.A. to make a presentation at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory.
Name dropper.
Yeah, well, I, how often does one get invited there?
You know? I can tell you never
well,
in my
you know,
book.
Well, do you know what it is?
What?
At places like the Applied Physics Laboratory, there are a lot of sci-fi fans. You know, because
yes.
that's what they're dealing
sure.
with is science and all. Anyway, they invited me to come back and talk about how I sort of use science fiction as a metaphor and allegory to talk about societal issues and that sort of thing. And I had to change planes in Phoenix. And the plane, when we got there, the aircraft was not working. They said, oh, you got to go over to another gate. So I ended up walking from the gate where I was all the way to the other end of the Phoenix airport with the pilot. And we were just talking, you know, where he's from, where I'm from, what are you doing? And, you know, and I mentioned that I was going to go to the APL. I was also going to New York to do an interview with Sirius XM radio. And out of the blue, this wonderful American Airlines pilot named Scott Gause, he said, let me tell you the show you ought to do, man. It's Coast to Coast. Totally out of the blue. And I said, well, that's really interesting, Scott, because I'm going to be there in 2 weeks. And I told him that I would give him a shout out. I hope he can take a look away from the controls long enough to listen and hear it. Scott Gause, he said, my name is easy. It's Shag spelled backwards. So I got it right. But it was really charming to run into that and have that kind of encounter and to hear about your show. And he said, they do some really weird stuff on that show.
Yes, we do.
You know, and being a pilot, he said, very often he's, you know, getting up very early in the morning to fly a plane or something. But he said, I hear it all the time and I love it. And so kudos to you guys and the guys that do the show here. It was fun to hear about anyway.
Well, great. And we've got so much to talk about, but before we kind of launch into all of these amazing series that you were part of, Kenny, you've got a new novel, The Man of Legends, and it even got a special Amazon Kindle first pre-release back on June 1st, and it's already a bestseller?
It's amazing. It comes out it's released in full release mm-hmm. on July 1st in print and in audiobook and in digital and in the regular Kindle. But they have this special deal where the editors of Amazon get together and they pick like six of their upcoming books mm-hmm. to be given this Kindle first premiere a month earlier. And it happened just 2 weeks ago on the 1st of June. To my astonishment, it was like overnight, it was a bestseller the first day. I think they have over 1 million titles in mm-hmm. the Kindle store, and we started at number two, and we've been hovering around number five ever since then. And it's just been amazing. But even more rewarding, Dave, has been the feedback that I've gotten already from the people who have read it. They have, you know, like their little 5-star rating at Amazon.
Right.
And we have had like 4.4 out of 5 stars from the get-go. I think the last time we looked, there was something like 140, 160, reader reviews. And so many of them have really made me happy.
That's awesome.
Well, it's great, you know, when you can hear directly back from your audience like
right.
that. It's really, really
can be great or really frightening.
Well, that's true. Either one, it works both ways. But just to give you a sort of a quick overview of what it is, I sort of think of it as a supernatural mystery.
Okay.
I'm trying to do some epic sort of stories and adventure, and there's a lot of suspense and tension in it and that sort of thing. But there's also this wonderful love story, and all of it is rooted in what I've discovered is one of the great untold legends of human history that nobody's ever really explored before. And I was intrigued by this. And the story takes place in New York City over New Year's weekend mm-hmm. of 2001. So it's just a 3 or 4 day period.
Sure.
But there are flashes back over the last 2,000 years, back to the Holy Land, and then further back beyond that into some primal imagery from like Paradise Lost and really deep mythology. And the hero is this really engaging guy, flesh and blood guy like you or me, who made a mistake like you or I might easily have made,
mm-hmm.
but it brought down on him this terribly grave consequences. And he has had to remain alive ever since that happened. And he cannot die, and he cannot stay in one place for more than 3 days. Before it has to move on. There's like needles in the back of his brain if he doesn't move, and he has to move it, you know, further down the road every 3 days. And so Obviously, it sort of becomes the story becomes kind of a quest to understand why this has happened to him, what his reason for being is. That's sort of the theme, actually, that runs through the whole story. Most of the principal characters are trying to sort of discover their reason for being. But the beauty of the character is that when you're having to constantly move like this across the world for like the last 20 centuries, you meet a lot of people.
Right.
And you could, I realize, meet a whole lot of very important historical people, and you could impact on them in a way that, or inspire them in a way that would literally change the course of human history, which is what he has done for the last 20 centuries. And it's really an intriguing path to follow. Both for good and for bad. I mean, he's basically a good guy, but sometimes no good deed goes unpunished,
right.
You know. And he's been pursued for about the last 1,600 years by authorities from the Vatican, who are eager to contain him and capture him because of the treasure that he represents to them, but also the danger that he represents to their empire and to organized religion in general because of what he knows. His latest nemesis is a French priest, a very devious, duplicitous, clever man who is going to be the one that brings him in. I was sort of inspired by Inspector Javert in Les Miserables.
Oh, sure.
You know, that kind of determined, obsessed man.
Intensity,
and,
right?
And he's enlisted the New York Archdiocese and the NYPD, and they're all sort of closing in on New Year's weekend. But there are also two women who are eagerly seeking him. One is a reporter for like a National Enquirer tabloid kind of paper, and she has seen this man's face in photographs taken at three different times, like 150 years apart. And the guy is in the same photograph. I mean, he looks the same, you know. And then she chances to see a news broadcast, a local news broadcast in New York, where this heroic, unidentified man has just saved the life of this little 5-year-old Latina girl from a burning tenement house in Spanish Harlem. The walls collapsed on him, though, and he's like 90% burned over his body, broken bones. He's in a coma. He's not expected to live. But she sees them slipping him into the paramedic van, and she sees his face and goes, "It's the guy. Wait a minute. Who is this?" And at the same time, there's another woman who is very different. She's an 85-year-old sort of Catherine Hepburn, feisty New England lady, former United Nations envoy, who was his lover 60 years ago.
Please tell me that you're doing the audiobook version for this, too.
Yes, I'll get to that. I'll get to that,
right.
Because it's really fun. But she was the love of his life, and he was the love of her life. She traveled with him, understood who he was and why it was going on for a year, but then he forced himself to separate from her because he knew it would be too painful for her to watch him remain young while she kept growing older. He'd been through that with his wife and his children 2,000 years earlier. But now she's sort of slipping into Alzheimer's, and she's so hoping to reunite with him before she loses all of her memories. And she sees the same newscast, and it's like, oh my God, and is closing in on it. And it's there's also one other character that I need to mention. He's described in the book as a sleek young man. I use sort of Leonardo DiCaprio or Jude Law in my head as I was writing. That sort of absolutely charming, friendly, humorous guy who's been shadowing our hero for the whole 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's something else going on with him, and we suspect early on that he's an emissary of darker forces, which indeed he is. And the whole thing sort of comes to this amazing conclusion in a warehouse on the Upper West Side of Manhattan at the end. Where he ends up surrounded by 100 or so people whom he's encountered over just this weekend in Manhattan, and who are for some reason drawn to be with him at the time. And part of the fun of the novel is that it's told in the first person by about 15 different people, by the different people that have encountered him, including the reporter, who was not only an eyewitness but also a participant in what's going on. That Catherine Hepburn type lady,
right,
has got her voice too. Even our hero has his voice in it. So when we did the audiobook, I brought in a dozen of my favorite actors, several of them from Alien Nation, as a matter of fact. Eric Pierpoint, who was my lead in Alien Nation, my lead alien. Eric did the voice of Will, who is my hero. and Terry Trees, who was the beautiful alien across the hall in Alien Nation. She did an old sort of drugged out carny little alcoholic thing, and it didn't look like Terry at all. Jeff Marcus, who played Albert, the slightly handicapped janitor, mentally handicapped janitor in Alien Nation, is in it for me, as well as Carrie Keene and a couple of other friends. So the audiobook really plays like a radio play.
Awesome. You know? And, I love that. This kind of a theater of the mind that you're opening
exactly
up.
That's exactly the kind of thing. And I decided to write the book in that fashion because it gave me an opportunity to get inside a character's head and really, you know, dig into it deeply. It was fun.
Check it out. Man of Legends. You got to go pre-order. Get in on that right now. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We've got more with Kenny Johnson and more about some of the most fascinating TV ever produced. We'll cover that here on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining me this evening. Again, I'll be here with you tomorrow as well. Listen, if you love what you hear on Coast to Coast, you're going to love what you see on George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief. You can join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for a dynamic discussion on all things paranormal, conspiracies, and unexplained. That's right. There's 7 seasons, over 266 episodes available. The brand new episode you can find right now on the site at beyondbelief.com, Climate Change and the Vatican with Daniel Sheehan. And there's a free episode you can check out for yourself as well, The Truth on UFO Cases with Nick Pope. Those are available on the site, plus all of the other past episodes. So you can go subscribe and keep up with all the great shows that George Norrie does, aside from Coast to Coast AM. See it for yourself on Beyond Belief. And if you'd like to meet George Norrie in person and some of the most fascinating guests, there's a few ways you can do that. As a matter of fact, you've got the Eat and Greet Luncheon Series that take place at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks. The next one coming up on June 27th. That's the next in the Luncheon Series. George Norrie will be joined by Rich Martini. And you can also find out more information. George will be live Saturday, July 29th at the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington, along with guests Robert Felix, Sonia Grace, Mike Barra, and John Hogue. From radio to stage, you get a chance to enjoy the grand experience and bringing one of radio's number one talk show personalities in the world live to the stage. You can enjoy watching George Norrie as he interviews some of today's brightest experts in the field of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. It's a 3-hour stage show that consists of interviews combined with video, music, singing, and all of this creates an unforgettable experience for theater goers and fans of the very popular show Coast to Coast AM. And coming up this November, Time for Truth, Living La Vida Loca. You can check out the Time for Truth UFO Symposium in Laughlin, Nevada at the Aquarius Casino Resort. George will host a cocktail party on Friday, November 10th, and interview Clifford Stone on Saturday, November 11th. You can find more information on all of these events by visiting coasttocoastam.com and click on George's tab. Then you can follow up and see what George has got going on and how you can keep up with him live and with his TV shows. When we come back talking about TV shows, what was it like to be a part of some of the most iconic sci-fi TV series in the world? We'll talk to the man that knows firsthand, Kenny Johnson, my guest this evening here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. And tonight in studio, I'm very lucky to be graced with the presence of Kenny Johnson, who is behind many of the most iconic TV shows of my youth and many of the listeners here on Coast to Coast AM. We just talked about his new novel, The Man of Legends. First of all, what a fascinating story. Did I hear some slight shadowing and reflections of even the Incredible Hulk in that, where he's always on the move every couple of days, has to move on to affect some other part of life and somebody else's life?
Yeah, it's interesting. I realized as I was into it that there were certainly echoes of the Hulk. There's even
right.
a couple of little inside jokes to our Hulk fans, friends out there when they read the book, they, you know, that they'll see that too. But what intrigued me about this character was the fact that he would be able to interact with a lot of historical people that we've heard about. You know, I mean, he was a shipmate. It turns out he was a shipmate with Herman Melville on a whaling ship, you know, and he suggested movable type to this metalsmith named Gutenberg. And so suddenly, you know, things develop.
So you've almost got a little bit of a Forrest D. Gump feel
funny.
To this, too.
Exactly. Jason Kirk, who was the editor at Amazon who bought the book, We had been approached by Harper's and Little Brown and some of the other major publishers, but Jason just came at me from Amazon and just so got it and understood what I was trying to do and the fun that we could have with it, because here's a guy that you know, can have conversations with Mark Twain and suggest things that make Mark Twain what he is. One of my favorite, I think, little throwaway pieces is when he gets involved with this Scotsman up in Glasgow named James Watt in the 1700s, who's trying to get this infernal contraption called the steam engine to work, and he can't quite get it going right. And our hero Will has seen some things in his travel that gives him some suggestions that he passes along to James Watt, and so pretty quickly, pa-pung, in 3 days, the steam engine is working. And so not only did he help Watt create the steam engine, but he helped kickstart the Industrial Revolution. But also, while he's there, he uses the steam valve, relief valve, to heat up a little warm milk there to pour in coffee, and he creates the first cappuccino, you know. So there's a lot of fun like
that's
that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And but also, you know, a lot of times, as I said, no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, it's a good thing when he could save a little child in the Bavarian Alps from a blizzard in the 1800s. And it's a good thing. He saves the child, almost freezes to death himself. But except the problem is the child grows up to be the grandfather of Adolf Hitler. And, you know, so part of what the story talks about is the ripple effect that our actions have. And we have to think about, you know, how they can affect other people in, you know, in other ways.
And does the hero have an understanding of how that ripple effect happened? Does he realize that it was Hitler's grandfather?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's part of the reason that he later became part of the Valkyrie plot to assassinate Hitler.
Trying to clean up his own mess.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly. And so that there's that constant, you know, trying of seeking to do the right thing, because it's really basically a very humanistic book and about how it's about a right way to live more than anything else. But at the same time, you know, what I've always tried to do, Dave, is to take a high concept mm-hmm. like this, some man who cannot die kind of situation, and a concept that will intrigue people, that will catch their attention, catch their imagination. And then once I get them, I have to, of course, deliver a story that
right.
makes good on all of that and keep them engaged. But also, I've always tried to work sort of thematically and see what I could work into the story that would give it some substance and some underlying depth. And certainly, I've always, throughout my whole career, tried to inspire as much tolerance and humanism as I could, because I, oddly enough, I was raised in a very bigoted anti-Semitic household. And I heard the hate words all the time, every night at dinner, and I was an only child, so I had nobody to bounce off of. And somehow it didn't stick. I just instinctively felt that this was wrong. I couldn't bring myself ever to use those words or anything. And so through my whole career, I've tried to sort of, wherever I could, chip away at that, you know, kind of intolerance and prejudice. And Alien Nation was, of course, the classic example
right.
of doing that.
And that was so fantastically told, to take it from that movie and then adapt it for TV.
Well,
do it justice. And well, almost, I think, in my opinion, and again, not meaning to kiss up, it was almost far superior to the movie, which was a great kernel of an idea that you fleshed out beautifully.
You know, it's so funny, and thank you very much for that. I had a lot of very talented people helping me to do that. But when my friends called me from Fox, a friend of mine was head of Fox TV, and he called and said, "We've got this movie that didn't do very well, but there might be a premise. Would you come and look at it?" And he told me it was Alien Nation. And by then, I had already done The Incredible Hulk, The Bionic Woman, V, and you know, I was more and more, I was being thought of as the sci-fi guy.
Right.
You know, that's what they do in this town. And I said, okay. Well, I'll look at it. And I looked at the movie sitting alone in the screening room in Fox, and it was like sort of Miami Vice with Coneheads.
Right.
You know, it was such a good premise, but it didn't. And I was just about, I didn't even want to sit through the rest of the movie. But then there was this one scene where the alien cop gets picked up at his home by his human partner, and he waves to his family on the porch. And it's his wife and two little kids, alien kids. And the bell went off in my head, and I said, wait a minute, who are they? What's it like to be them? And I went back to the Fox executives and I said, okay, you think you've got like Lethal Weapon with aliens, right? And they said, yeah, yeah. And I said, no. What we have here is the opportunity to do In the Heat of the Night, is to do a piece that's about culture clash, about prejudice, about discrimination, and really talk about it right on the nose, right in your face, but never offend anybody.
Right.
And it was so cool because when it went on the air, I got this, we got a lot of wonderful letters. My favorite, I think, came from an African-American doctor in Detroit who said, I saw the show was coming on the air and it really made me angry. Why do they want to do another show about this alien stuff? Why doesn't somebody do a show about the black experience? He said, and then I saw your show and realized it was about the black experience, you know, and the Asian American community, the Hispanic American community, the LGBT community. Everybody gave us awards and honors because everybody thought it was about them.
Right. And you didn't force feed the dogma of anything. It was just it was showing the relation, which what I think is what Star Trek really honed in on, was being able to look at these different stories and aspects of our humanity.
Exactly.
And make them relatable. I want to ask you before we go too deep into the different shows.
Yeah.
With the book, you map this out and you've got such a rich history in TV and movies. Why isn't this a movie? Why didn't you bring it to movie instead of a novel?
You know, it's funny. When I first, I think I was reading Mark Twain's book called Innocents Abroad. It was sort of a travel book that he did for when he was early in his career. And he mentioned this, my character, my leading character, because he's a character that is a legendary character that people have heard about sort of vaguely, but they don't know who he was or what, you know, he was all about. And I realized that Mark Twain wrote about him. And then I started digging into the research, and I realized that Percy Shelley, the poet, had written a couple of poems about him, having apparently met him. And this was like 50, 60 years before Mark Twain. And the deeper I got into it, the more I realized there were reports about this man that went back into the 1600s, the 1400s, the 1200s. And I thought, wait a minute. This is too rich a character. And I actually started writing a screenplay. But I realized that I couldn't do service to the character and the wondrous thing that I had stumbled onto here, to try to cram it into 2 hours of a movie was just not going to do it service. And I just settled back and I said, okay, I really do need to do this as a novel so that I can really do the breadth of it. And then maybe if I'm lucky, we'll turn it maybe into a miniseries, you know, that where you
have Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, are you listening?
There you go.
This is exactly what we love to watch, these type of experiences. Yeah. And do you have a little bit of fear though? That, you know, he's going to come looking for you and want his residuals for you writing about his life. I think, yeah.
You know, stranger things have happened. But I tell you, if this guy walked into your life, it would be a good thing for everybody that he runs into.
Now, Amazon's already locked you up for a second book. Is it going to be a sequel to this?
That's what they asked for. And it could be, because the story, although it comes to a conclusion, could conceivably continue on. But I said, no, I really feel like I've done the story that I want to do here. It's got a good beginning, middle, and an end, as Aristotle says that you're supposed to do, and I always have followed. And I said, besides, I have another idea. How about, let me just give you a few minutes about that. And I did, and they said, okay, we like that. and they bought it. And as a matter of fact, I just turned in the manuscript for that a couple of weeks ago, and I'm just about to start the final copy edit on it. But that's next year. We'll come back and talk about that.
I'm all for it. Yeah. Let's start to talk about some of your background. You just talked about your childhood kind of raised in this environment, bigoted, anti-Semitic kind of environment, which helped to, it seems like, help birth the idea of understanding and acceptance.
I think it did, you know, because it just, as I said, it just felt wrong. You know, Oscar Hammerstein in South Pacific wrote that lyric that he won the Pulitzer Prize for. The song was called "You've Got to Be Taught Before It's Too Late." Before you're 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate, you've got to be carefully taught. And for some reason, it just didn't stick. And then when I was 13, Dave, I had an extraordinary experience. I was, of course, being a geek, I was in the audiovisual aid club.
Sure.
You know, so that I could run the projectors.
I was there.
There, of course. Right. Of course you would be, right?
You are correct.
Right. But it was in seventh grade. I was 13. And we had a junior senior high that was combined. And I had heard that one of the seniors had brought in a roll of film that his father, who was a general at the Pentagon, was going to allow this one class of advanced seniors only to see at the school. And I thought, I'm not gonna let that slip by.
Right.
You know, and I broke out of my lunchroom and had a key to the audiovisual room. So I went and I found the film, set up a projector in a closet, literally, and I screened this film on the wall there. And Dave, what it was all of the footage that was used in evidence in the war crime trials at Nuremberg. This was all of the liberation of the concentration camps that the Soviets and the Americans and the British took, the film that they took. of these. I had never in my life seen skeletal human beings
right.
walking around. I had never conceived of seeing piles of hundreds of thousands of people being pushed by literally by a bulldozer into a mass grave. And it was staggering to see. I had never heard the word Holocaust, certainly not in my family. And I was really, it was profound. And I went home that night and mentioned it to my parents. And the reaction, I am embarrassed to tell you, was they said, too bad they didn't finish the job. And it was, yeah, that's so.
How does it impact you as a child when you hear this kind of hate coming from the people who are supposed to raise you to be a better person?
It was so...
Did they ever give you explanations, Kenny, of why
there was this anger? My mother was born in Arkansas, as I was, and so was my biological father, and they were raised there. My father on a cotton plantation, literally. But they were divorced after World War II, and we'd moved to Washington by then. And my daddy went back to said, "Come on, Helen, it's time to go back to Little Rock." And my mother said, "No, I'm staying in Washington." And they were divorced, and she remarried an Irish Catholic guy from Worcester, Massachusetts, a real Yankee. But he was a bigger bigot against black people than she was.
Wow.
And people who were Jewish were the bottom end of the scale for him because they had, I kept hearing, had robbed his stolen his company from him and all of this. And decades later, I heard from an eyewitness who was reliable who said, no, there were no Jewish people involved in your stepfather's failure. He was just a bad businessman, you know. So it was just the way it was. And I just decided that I wasn't going to go that way and determined that I wouldn't. And so since then I've really, as I said, tried to chip away at it, you know, whenever I could to try to make the world a little bit better.
When did the spark come to life for you regarding science fiction? I mean, to go from that, and that's a humanitarian side of life, to fantasy and release.
Well,
what was that like?
I think I had enjoyed a lot of the first book that I spent all night reading was Journey to the Center of the Earth, Jules Verne. I was so captivated. And then that took me through all of the rest of Jules Verne. And then I got into H.G. Wells and War of the Worlds and The Invisible Man and all of that. And then into some of the later contemporary authors like Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury and the people that were also influencing people like Rod Serling, who I got to know pretty well later on. And it was that was sort of the thing that sparked me into it. What I enjoyed about science fiction was the what-if aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just life as usual. It was something else. My friend, my dear late friend, Steve Cannell, who created the Rockford Files and A-Team and everything.
Greatest American Hero.
Exactly,
right?
All of those.
Magnum P.I., right.
What-if was Steve's license plate, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was something that I think drew me into it a lot, too. And it's funny because... in reading the science fiction, I at one point came across the radio play script for The War of the Worlds that Orson Welles had done in 1939 that scared the pants off of everybody.
Right.
People thought it was a live broadcast and that the Martians had landed in New Jersey. And it really frightened people. And I said, this is so cool. And by then being an AV geek, I had bought a tape recorder, a reel-to-reel tape recorder that was, you know, about the size of a suitcase and weighed 10,000 pounds. I said, you know, this is cool. I've got this radio play script. I'll get together a bunch of my eighth and ninth grade friends, and we did our own version of War of the Worlds. So my first production was a dramatic production was War of the Worlds on tape.
And how old were you when you did this?
I was 14.
Wow.
You know, and
we share a lot in that. I used to sit in the garage with my buddy with our little block tape recorder, doing Hardy Boys mysteries and stories. So I'm with you. That's
exactly right. It. It was so fun. But what happened is very quickly too was that my teachers all wanted to play it for all the different classes in school, and suddenly I was known as the drama guy in school, you know, and that led to me doing more plays and stuff in high school, and eventually realizing that the theater was the way that I wanted to go with my life. And then I got into the drama department at Carnegie Tech, which is a theater school. There's no film or TV. It was all pure theater, theater, Shakespearean and Stanislavski and all. And it was, but I was lucky enough to have encountered a guy named Bill Pence, who was a big man on campus and who ran the school newspaper, and also this thing called Film Arts Society, where we screened classic films, and I helped him to do it and ended up taking it over. Bill, incidentally, went on to create the Telluride Film Festival, which he ran for 35 years. But so I had the great theater training on one hand, but at the same time I was seeing all these great movies on the other hand. Bill really introduced me to cinema. I'd always been a movie fan. But Bill introduced me to the world of really classic cinema from all over the world, and it was a great way to blend the two things, and I realized ultimately that film was the way that I wanted to go.
Kenny Johnson, our guest. We have him for a whole nother hour. We'll even open up phone lines if you have some questions. We've got so much more to cover as we continue talking with this man behind so many of the most iconic shows, $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, Incredible Hulk, Alien Nation. He has a brand new book called The Man of Legends. You can find information on Amazon Kindle. You can go out and sign up for that right now. And you can check out his website, kennethjohnson.us. That's kennethjohnson.us. I am your host this evening, sitting in for George Norrie. I'm Dave Schrader. Go check out my website. Keep up with what we're doing. You can find me at darknessradio.com. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM.